communities, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
You know, it's the boy Dash all the way from Grenada, and it's tuned into C-Cut 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 6 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Spoken Word Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with Jérôme Saunier on summer accessibility in Montreal. Plus, an episode of Talking Radical Radio. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448, extension 2593, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, @AvalancheCKUT. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:03 p.m. On today's show, an interview with Jérôme Saunier on summer accessibility in Montreal. That's up now. Hi, Jérôme.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Would you be able to introduce yourself and talk about your work as a disability advocate?
Yeah, I've been doing this for quite a few years now. I use a wheelchair, so I focus mainly on issues concerning like universal accessibility. That's my biggest pet peeve. So I've been working with EXECO, which is an organization that focuses on these issues, basically people with reduced mobility. And I've also been working with Projet Montréal. You know, they have a committee on accessibility, and we've been trying to our issues and concerns inside the party.
So the borough of Verdun recently added a mobile library location close to its beach. Mm. Is this location accessible?
The location is not accessible in a manual wheelchair because it's the library is on the lawn, if you will. Mm-hmm. So that's not accessible in a wheelchair. So the library itself is not accessible. There's steps leading to it, and the door would be too narrow to accommodate a wheelchair in the first place. So.
What issues does it pose in opposed to its permanent location? contrasting the auxiliary site at the beach and the permanent location on Bannatyne, what would you say the differences are?
Oh, so the location on Bannatyne is more accessible, except that they don't have an automatic door. So, and it's impossible to open it because you're in a slope, you know, going up the door, going up to the door. You can't really pull on it, so that doesn't work. And when once you get inside the building, they have some type of an elevator, which is more like something they use for books and stuff. But you can use it. You can use it if you're on a wheelchair. Except sometimes they store boxes there next to the entrance, and you can't really access it in the first place.
So Article 28, Section F of the Montreal Charter of Rights and Responsibilities state that one of the city's responsibility is, quote, promoting universal access and developing its territory, as well as universal access to municipal buildings, communications, programs, and services in general. Do you feel that the city followed through with its obligations on the Verdun Library Auxiliary site?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This library is a total outrage, and it should never have happened that way. I spoke to councillors at the Verdun Borough Council, and they agreed with me, and they said it should never have happened that way. Public Works took the initiative of refurbishing an old trailer, and then there was no coordination with the actual elected officials or whatever, and so it totally fell through the cracks, and that's what we get.
And can you describe more of this lack of communication between Public Works and elected officials for this project specifically?
Well, in general, there's a total lack of awareness on the part of city officials in general and at all levels of the administration, basically. They don't really know what disability is about. They don't really know what to do about it. Universal accessibility is kind of a mystery to them as well. So there's a lot of awareness raising to be done within the administration. And so basically, once they know more, I guess they'll be able to better communicate these things. I don't know. It's like there's a lot of work to be done on communication as well. Yeah.
And would you be able to describe the work that Public Works does in opposed to the city?
Well, Public Works takes care of all kinds of things relating to road and snow removal and stuff like that.
And what would the city's responsibilities have been with this site in particular?
Well, they should have, as you said, they should have respected Article 24, is it? 28, sorry, of the Charter. And also Article 16, which specifies that the city commits itself to fighting ableism. Since last year, they modified the charter to include ableism in the types of discriminations that the city is committed to fighting against. And so you should have thought about that. I mean, that's what they have to do now. It's there, you know, they could be committed to that, supposedly.
And have you noticed obstacles in accessing other public city initiatives this summer?
Biggest mistakes that the city recently made about public facilities at the new biodome and the new insectarium. These facilities are not fully accessible, despite the obligations of the city under the charter, the Montreal Charter, and also the Quebec Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms. So, if you go to the biodome, they build this huge staircase that goes up into the canopy. In the tropical forest section, I think, something like that. And so, and that section obviously is not accessible if you're using a wheelchair or something. You can't go up the stairs. So why didn't they like think about that and build something that's accessible to everyone? You know, they were starting from scratch, right? They totally, totally destroyed the interior and remade it from scratch. So, that was one of the big things that they totally screwed up recently, that I know of.
And it's particularly upsetting because they had been closed for several years now in order to do this project. So they had the time, they had the money.
That's right.
I don't know if they did consultations for it, but clearly there was something missing in order for them to allow this to happen, essentially.
Yeah, so when I asked the question to the councillor who was in charge of that at the time, during budget consultations, she said that, well, it's equivalent, you know, because mm-hmm. they do have elevators that mm-hmm. bring you up to the mezzanine, but you don't get the whole experience of going through the canopy of trees, right? So how is it equivalent?
What is your opinion on the way that Montreal currently seeks opinions and consultations of disabled people in terms of a city planning process?
I mean, there's all kinds of consultation going on. Plan d'urbanisme et de mobilité mm-hmm. is being consulted upon right now. I don't think there's anything specifically for disabled people in that consultation.
So the city has a committee that they consult for accessibility issues mm-hmm. called the Comité Consultif des Usagers Vulnérables, so the CCUV, for public initiatives is part of Vision Zero. Would you, based on information I was able to find online, it's primarily people that are associated with an organization or a working group. Do you feel that consultation on accessibility issues should be made with the greater public, or do you have any comments on this process?
Yeah, I agree that everybody should be able to take part in those consultations, whether you belong to an organization or not. So yeah, I agree it should be more open, yeah, for sure.
And what's a benefit to these consultations being more open?
Well, you get more points of view, basically. I guess organizations are very focused on what they do. So they do it well. They know the issues they need to push and everything. But maybe people outside those organizations would have different ideas. I don't know.
And how do you feel the aspect of lived experience? So, for example, if you are a person with visual impairments, being consulted specifically based on your own experience and not from an organizational standpoint, what does that contribute to the conversation versus an organizational spokesperson?
You get more of an array of experiences to take into account when you design things, I guess.
So what has your opinion been so far on bringing forth accessibility issues with the borough or the city at large?
As far as we've done, I have to say the borough and the elected officials are very open to these issues. I keep bringing up that I encounter on Wellington, for instance. I send photos to the persons in charge, and they are grateful for it. For instance, that's pretty good.
And what is an example of an issue that you saw within the borough and how you brought it forth to the city and how they responded to it?
Well, for instance, currently there's all kinds of terraces on Wellington. Mm-hmm. And terraces are not always accessible because the person that build them don't necessarily respect the plans. Mm-hmm. You know, the plans that were approved by the borough. So they're supposed to be accessible on paper, but they need to be constructed in a way that respects the plans. And so, yeah, that's the kind of things you can report, and they're pretty good at following up on that.
And do you feel that there needs to be greater oversight on how these terraces are actually executed, or do you feel that the current system is okay?
I think their inspectors are doing all they can, really. They don't have that many. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there could be some improvements made, but I'm not sure what exactly. Yeah, maybe they should inspect them more during the building.
So the Accessible Canada Act passed in 2019, and it mandated that future government buildings be accessible. Do you feel that provincial initiatives should have a similar act?
Absolutely. So they have accessibility statutes in Ontario, Manitoba, Nova Scotia, BC, and Newfoundland. So yeah, that's definitely something we must adopt in Quebec as well. Yeah.
And is there anything similar or that can be expanded on in Quebec in terms of legislation, or do you feel a new act should be introduced, or new bill rather?
They need to work on something completely different from what we have, yeah. Because universal accessibility is not something that's it is in the construction code. You have certain standards to abide by, and you have a few rules, but it's not up to date in the first place. So yeah, there's a lot of work to be done in terms of getting legislation and regulations that really to really make it happen. Yeah.
And what are some of these examples of something being out of date in the provincial legislations?
I was speaking about specifically a regulation, which is the construction, the building code, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so the building code is not up to date in terms of, I mean, there's a lot of details, can't go really into the details, but yeah, that's something that needs to be worked on. So basically it's based on the Canadian thing, and each province adapts that to their own context, mm-hmm. but it takes years from... It's really a very long and difficult thing to really change. So I think we need to work on new regulations and new legislation, yeah, for sure.
And do you have examples of other provinces that you would like to see Quebec emulate? Or would you rather that we create something kind of entirely different?
Ontario has got this pretty cool act. It's an accessibility act they've had since 2005. Yeah, apparently it's working pretty good in terms of improving the built environment and everything. And also, for instance, apparently the Toronto subway will be completely accessible by 2025. You know, that kind of stuff. If we had an act like this, a statute like that in Quebec, maybe the Montreal Metro would be made accessible more quickly, mm-hmm. for instance. And we wouldn't get total fiascos like the biodome and stuff like that, you know? Mm-hmm.
And even though, like, some of the metro stations are currently undergoing renovations in order to become more accessible, it's taking a long time. And it's been years that some stations have been under renovation in order to get elevators. How specifically would legislation help initiatives like that comply with new accessibility measures?
Well, for one thing, there would be more funding, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that would be something. Because the STM and the city are always begging the government for more money. And the mm-hmm. government's not very willing to comply, right?
And are there any other issues besides budget that you feel are contributing to Montreal and the province of Quebec as a whole in not being as accessible as their charter state they would be?
Yeah, budget is a major issue. If you just look at paratransit, for instance, the mm-hmm. paratransit service of the STM. So the provincial government used to fund it up to 75% of the costs, and now they're down to 50%. And we're losing cab drivers because it costs more money now to adapt your taxi to make it wheelchair accessible and everything. And so, and there's no funding for that. I mean, the funding is not sufficient. So yeah, funding is the primary problem, I guess, yeah.
And regarding public initiatives like pedestrianized streets or the mobile library site, do you feel that budget and a legislation of sorts would also impact the future accessibility of those iterations? So for example, if something were to pass, do you feel that 2023, these sites would be more accessible?
If you have requirements in the law or in regulations that you need to comply with, yes, for sure. It will change a lot of things, yeah.
And how has the City of Montreal contributed thus far to enforce accessibility in public initiatives?
I'm not sure they're working very hard on this. I must say I'm really disappointed. I continue to be disappointed. They're not moving very, very fast. For instance, when they created bike paths on Saint-Denis, they didn't think of, for instance, well, you know, they made a sound, you know, for blind people to be able to ride themselves on the street. And so, yeah, they didn't think of that so much when they planned the new bike path. And so that created a lot of problems and confusion. And basically, I think they had to turn them off. Mm-hmm. And I think that they said they would work on that, but I'm not sure where they are really at this point. So that's an example of completely disregarding the needs of disabled people.
You said that they haven't done enough. What would they need to do in order to better follow these accessibility guidelines and make the city and province accessible for disabled people?
Wow, there's so much to be done. It's like insane. I mean, we haven't scratched the surface. I mean, it's like everything needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Everything at all levels, provincial, municipal, yeah.
How can we redefine our new normal in order to create a more accessible world post-pandemic in terms of city accessibility?
Yeah, city accessibility doesn't just relate to public spaces. It also mm-hmm. also concerns like private spaces, like mm-hmm. local shops. Local shops are, I think a majority of local shops are on commercial streets are not accessible because they have a step in front, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's something that needs to be worked on. I mean, the city could adopt like regulations to kind of force building owners to make their premises accessible.
And do you feel that private businesses without regulation from the government are doing enough in order to make things accessible for customers and clients?
Now, far from it, they're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
There is a subsidy program at city level. Mm-hmm. Where you can get $15,000, I believe,
mm-hmm.
to make your business accessible. But that's really not enough. It's really not enough money. So owners and business owners, they're reluctant to use that because it would cost them a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
And since they don't have any obligation to make their premises accessible.
What do you think non-disabled people would be able to do in terms of helping make disabled people have a more accessible experience in public spaces this summer?
It's really a big question.
I feel that at the moment, unfortunately, a lot of the people that are speaking up about inaccessibility within the city and specifically public initiatives are mm-hmm. primarily disabled people.
Right.
So what would non-disabled people be able to do in order to help support us?
They need to commit to fight ableism.
Mm-hmm.
Tall order, right? So the city, I mean, basically, like a couple of weeks ago, we had, beginning of June, we had the Quebec Disability Week.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city should have used the opportunity to, you know, talk about it and, you know, and maybe tell us what they plan on doing. There wasn't much of anything. And non-disabled people must absolutely denounce every situation where they see that there's discrimination against disabled people. You know, they need to bring it up to bring those up to the attention of elected officials and business owners or whoever's responsible for the issue. Yeah.
And if people do spot those issues, what would you recommend that they do or say in order to have the issue addressed?
I mean, I guess it depends on everyone. I mean,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you have to reach out to the people in charge. You know?
Mm-hmm. Or
tell them that's the situation is unacceptable and they need to fix it. As I said before, the provincial elections are coming up,
mm-hmm.
October 3rd. And so I think right now we need to, I mean, the campaign has not started yet, but right now we need to really try and reach out to candidates and the party and provincial parties to make those points, right? This is the opportunity. So our concerns are part of the conversation during the campaign, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need to do. There's a lot of topics to talk about, but you know, just simply asking those people what do they want to do to promote a universal accessibility in Quebec as a whole, mm-hmm. not just Montreal, but as Quebec as a whole. What are their plans? What's in their platform for that? You know, and if they have nothing in their platform, do they maybe want to talk about it anyways? And maybe, you know, not maybe commit to something, to doing something. You know, like there's so many issues. Like just if we just had other more advanced provinces, if we had an accessibility statute
mm-hmm.
on the books, maybe that would help. That would be a big help. You know. So there's only one party, as far as I know right now, that wants to do that, and mm-hmm. it's Quebec Solidaire.
And do you know what Quebec Solidaire's plan is?
Yeah, it's pretty vague, but I think they do want to to adopt one of those accessibility statutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. So there's all kinds of things, and also the funding for paratransit and the funding for the elevators in the metro, in the Montreal metro, and the funding for home services, you know, home mm-hmm. care. People are not getting the care they need because, as we know, there's a shortage of staff, first of all, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they're not paid enough. The pay is mm-hmm. too low. They will work for hospitals and stuff instead of going to people's homes and giving them the services that they need.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of the lack of funding, again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to raise the salaries right now. I think that they make something like $19 an hour with the COVID premium or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be paid like at least $22, $23, something more, I mean, a more attractive pay
mm-hmm.
to actually offer the service to the people who need it. Yeah, so these are issues that are dealt at the provincial level, right? Because mm-hmm. it's the provincial government that's in charge of that.
It sounds like that it has to be a multifaceted kind of proposal. It can't just be in regards to, for example, like public buildings, mm-hmm. but with like what you said, there also has to be a discussion around wage. And I feel like that can also be extended to just the minimum wage as a whole, because
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, disabled workers are more likely to get paid at minimum wage than anything else. And so do you feel all provincial parties are going to release a plan on disability action, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly wish they would, but I'm not sure they will.
Mm-hmm.
As we know, the CAC is not very keen on those things.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the others, I think the Liberals have released their platform already. I haven't looked at it, but I'd be surprised. But it needs to be part of the conversation during the elections.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's always more important stuff. We're always being sidelined mm-hmm. and deprioritized. We need to keep pushing.
And what do you feel would need to be done in order to have this greater cultural shift, to have people prioritize disabled people more than they have?
I mean, disabled people seem to be more a priority in other provinces. And they are, because they've got, you know, provincial statutes on accessibility
mm-hmm.
and such. So, yeah, I guess it starts at the top. The government needs to do something. It's to adopt whatever laws and regulations we need to change all this,
mm-hmm.
because we can keep. I mean, as disability advocates, we can keep screaming in the desert, but it's not going to get us anywhere.
Okay, so thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Music and anti-fascism: reflections on the past and possibilities in the present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, free improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022 at 9 p.m. La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni Peri Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. July 1st was Quebec's traditional moving day. This year, 4,000 households across the province sought help from their municipal authorities to find housing. As of July 2nd, 600 Quebec households did not have a home. 118 were in Montreal. Key reasons behind the housing crisis are low vacancy rates and rising rents. And Parks Canada cancelled its first of five camping events along the Lachine Canal, which was set to take place over the weekend. Advocates for Montreal's unhoused population critiqued the city. Advocates for Montreal's unhoused population critiqued the city for allowing paid participants to pitch tents on the land, but not letting unhoused people sleep there. And last Tuesday, dozens gathered outside McGill University's Schulich School of Music to protest the closure of its Conservatory of Music by the end of the summer. Unlike the Schulich School at large, the conservatory is open to the entire Montreal community and has offered private music lessons since 1904. McGill says the closure is due to increasing operational costs. And the Université Laval faculty union filed a grievance over Professor Patrick Provost's suspension, saying that this decision threatened academic freedom. Provost is a microRNA researcher, and he claimed that the risks of vaccinating children against COVID-19 outweigh the benefits. And now for some news you can use. July 1st was moving day in Quebec, but many households are still without a home. If you or someone you know needs help, you can call the housing advocacy group FRAPRU. It stands for Front d'Action Populaire en Aménagement Urbain. Their number is 514-522-1010. You can also call the City of Montreal for help at 311. And Shelter Movers Montreal needs volunteers. The organization helps victims of domestic violence leave their abusers, providing free moving and storage services. In the wake of Quebec's Moving Day, Shelter Movers Montreal has a waiting list of 2 months for these services. For more information on how to get involved, visit sheltermovers.com/volunteer. And the shelter, The Open Door, is looking for clothing donations, which you can drop off at 3535 Park Avenue. For more information, including what items are needed, visit the Mobilizing for MP Instagram page. And the menstrual equity nonprofit, Monthly Dignity, is looking for volunteers to head its communications and design team. The application deadline is July 18th. For more information, visit the Monthly Dignity Instagram page.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:31. Up next is an episode of Talking Radical Radio. This episode is titled Remembering a Radical Experiment, the Vancouver Mental Patients Association of the 1970s. A content warning on this episode for psychiatric hospitalization.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give participants in a wide range of social change work a chance to take a longer view as they talk about what they do, how they do it, and why they do it. On this week's show, I will be speaking with Jackie Hooper and Megan Davies about the radical early years of the Vancouver Mental Patients Association, or MPA, in the 1970s, and about a recent film project to recover some of that important history. In the early 1970s, the so-called mental health system was busily shifting people out of institutions, but doing far too little to support them in their new lives on the outside. The system was very hierarchical, and many people had experiences with it that were far from positive. At the same time, it was an era of radical possibility, with many social movements that were strong and growing. One such movement that is often forgotten in histories of the New Left era is amazing self-organizing that happened among people who had experience of the mental health system, mental patients or ex-inmates, as some people identified in that era, or psychiatric survivors or mad people, as some identify today. One of the earliest and most inspiring of these experiments in self-organization and mutual aid was the Vancouver MPA, which until its structure was forced to change by governments later in the decade, was democratic, largely non-hierarchical, and most important of all, incredibly effective. Hooper was an activist with the MPA in those years, and one of the group that actively shaped the recent film project. Davies is a historian at York University in Toronto, who was centrally involved in making the film. They talk about the radical early years of the Vancouver MPA and about the film called The Inmates Are Running the Asylum, Stories from MPA. I spoke to Hooper and Davies by phone from British Columbia.
My name is Megan Davies, and I'm a historian. I teach at York University in Toronto. This project that we're going to talk about is a public history project about the MPA, or the Mental Patients Association, that was started in late 1970, early 1971 in Vancouver. And this was in an era of deinstitutionalization in mental health. And there were very few community supports. And it we started a response to that gap of community support. A group of former patients and their supporters got together and started an organization to provide support in the form of a drop-in and eventually housing and work and cultural activities. The MPA is historically significant because it was the first group of its kind in Canada and one of the first in the world, in fact. And it also was really at the forefront of progressive social movements in Canada. In June 2010, so 3 years ago, with a couple of other academics, we started interviewing members from the early days of MPA. The interviews were so powerful and so evocative. People were so passionate about the early MPA. They loved the organization that we just couldn't say, oh, well, we're just going to take these interviews and do our academic analysis on them. So we did something that's quite unorthodox in the field of history. We invited our interviewees to help us interpret our research data and to make a research product for the History of Madness in Canada web pages. And they chose to make a documentary. And so we spent 3 years creating the documentary as a collaborative project, using our funding and our expertise and connections to provide the scaffolding for the project, but that we always tried to be the supporters, not the directors of the project. So the project was moved by the early MPA members that appear in the film.
I was one of the first MPA members. I guess it was late 71, 72. I was in the hospital, and in September, I got out of the hospital. I had a depressive episode. My diagnosis is major depression. Other places, it's bipolar. I never know. So when I was just getting out of the hospital, I asked the other patients, where shall I go? What shall I do? And one of them said, why don't you go to the new Mental Patients Association? I said, where is it? And they said, it's on the northeast corner in the house at 10th and Trudge in Kitsilano. So I went there, and there was quite a few people there. I guess there were about 12, 15, something like that, and a couple of them were sleeping in the basement. And I met them all, and suddenly I had friends, and my symptoms got better, and I stayed with MPA for years. The whole place was run at all times by general meetings. We had a great group of people, mostly mental patients. At the drop-in center, we had a big group. There must have been about, in general meetings, which ran the place from the bottom-up type of organization. We had schizophrenics and bipolars and everything you can imagine, and people with depression and anxiety, and the Indians from the Indian Center down the street, and people who would drop in, and a few Americans.
The original instigator of the group, Lanny Beckman,
yeah.
I think that this was his idea, that it would be a non-hierarchical organization and therefore readdress the traditional hierarchies in the psychiatric system by putting the patients and their supporters in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the principle, I think, that people who receive services are often the best people to decide what the services are that are useful. Given the very hierarchical nature of the mental health system at the time, and the fact that many of these people had been in institutions, this was tremendously empowering for people who had been in the mental health system. And it really changed their lives. That the MPA was very successful at getting funding. They got funding to hire people, but they didn't just hire people. People were given jobs. They had to run for them at elections, at these general meetings that Jackie's talking about.
Uh-huh.
So if you wanted a job, you had to run for that job, and then 6 months later, you would be up for election again. And one of the people in the film, John Hapfel, has spoken to me very movingly of how empowering that process was, because he said to me, you know, Megan, here you were elected by your peers to serve them. And, you know, this may be the first moment in your life where you'd got a job and you were elected by the people who you were going to take care of because they trusted you. So he says that that whole way in which the early MPA created work for people was just transformative. And then they right away recognized that housing was important. I think one of the people in the film talks about this early acknowledgement of the principle of housing first. And so they started buying houses. They got funding from the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And the houses, again, were run as collective. And so people who lived in them got to decide who their roommates were. But everybody did chores in the house and took turns doing the shopping and, I guess, the cooking, but with support. And again, very empowering for people who had had difficult mental health histories.
There was a great mixture of people, and we had a workshop, and they made things.
And you had photography equipment in a dark room.
That's right, too, yeah.
Yeah, and you put out the monthly tabloid newspaper.
Oh, yeah, in a nutshell. I edited it for a while. We had mental health issues and poems by people and stories. Seems to me we had a psychiatrist writing at one time, too.
In a nutshell, the newspaper had political stuff in it and personal stories. People published their poetry. And, you know, you've got to think again about how empowering that would be to see your stuff in print if you'd never written a poem before. There was artwork in a nutshell, and then just useful information like, you know, how to get from Riverview, the psychiatric hospital, to the MPA drop-in. So it was a very eclectic magazine, but it represented the kind of eclectic nature of MPA, and it was put out by members.
And we got a vehicle, and we used to go out to Riverview. I think once a week we'd go out to Riverview, and we'd sit on review panels. MPA members would. We'd sit on review panels when people were going to be discharged or trying to get discharged, and we'd speak up for them in these review panels.
What else can you tell me about the founding of the MPA?
Do you want me to tell the story, Jack?
Yeah, you know it.
Yeah, it's a bit of it's the story, right? And Lanny has written it and told it many, many times. It was in 1970, and Lanny had had his second hospitalization for severe depression. He'd come out of the psych ward at the Vancouver General Hospital, and he was attending a day program at the Burnaby Community Mental Health Center, the first community mental health center in Vancouver. And this group met Monday to Friday, and on the weekends there were no services offered. And what they found in the group was that people started committing suicide on the weekend because they had no support. And the people in the group, the patients, started circulating a phone list amongst themselves, but the people running the group didn't want that to happen and tried to shut that down based on the premise that they were the experts in providing mental health care. So it was this sort of secretive element to the beginnings of that. And then Lanny wrote a letter to a guy called Bob Hunter, who went on to become one of the founders of Greenpeace. But in 1970, Bob Hunter was writing as a columnist for the Vancouver Sun. And he had written a series of very scathing comments about Riverview Mental Hospital in Vancouver. So Lanny wrote to him about the situation and said, could you write a column about our idea and put in my phone number? And Bob Hunter did this. And, you know, as Lanny tells the story, his phone just rang off the wall. And they had their first meeting probably in early 1971. And about 80 people showed up at the first meeting. You know, and then the organization just took off from there for about the first 4 months. They didn't have much funding. I think their first funding was from the graduate students at UBC. They got, I think, $1,000. But then they started to get funding from the federal government. That's the myth of how MPA started. Well, it's the story of how MPA started. And it really was the first, there was nothing like that happening elsewhere in Canada, and really very few other places in the world, where there were patients coming out of institutions and forming forming their own group. And I think it's highly likely that the protest that you guys did at Riverview in 1973 was the first psychiatric protest, anti-psychiatry kind of protest globally.
I remember in the drop-in centers that we would stand practically any kind of behavior. In the 6th Avenue house near Maple, we had an upstairs room, and a guy named Al Barbo used to shout a lot, so we sent him upstairs, and he would shout and shout and shout and scream, so we called him Quiet Room Al. Remember that?
Yeah. I mean, the early MPA was very inclusive, and they started out with no rules whatsoever, as I recall, but they did put into place some very basic rules about respecting other people,
yeah.
No drugs, no alcohol, no violence.
Right.
But each decision, all those rules would have been decided by the general membership at these often long and lively meetings that they would have.
So you've talked about housing and a drop-in and a workshop and the newsletter. Were there other things that MPA was doing in those years as well?
I think that was about it. The drop-in was the central spot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what MPA did for its members in the early years that was really important was that it helped them form an analysis of their situation. So they were less likely, I think, to blame themselves for where they were, and more likely to see activism as a way forward. People from early MPA that we interviewed, people like Jackie, the MPA provided, you know, an avenue towards being an activist mental health consumer.
And one thing we lost was stigma. We didn't have anything do with it, and I still talk to people about it, even at the age of 86, and I think that spread through the city a little.
I asked Hooper and Davies how, given the power of that stigma, the early MPA challenged the skepticism that they surely faced from outsiders about people with mental illness running their own grassroots, democratic, non-hierarchical organization. Given how successful it was, why isn't the model of the MPA the dominant model now?
Well, it became bureaucratic in 1977 when I quit, and it was a top-down place from then on. I think a lot of the old members quit then. We were running it, and all of a sudden in 77 there was persuasion to have a top person. Not voted in, but hired.
administrators were unsympathetic, but they were unable, I think, to work with the structure of MPA. It simply...
Yeah, they wanted somebody to address who was the manager or something.
Yeah, they couldn't work with a non-hierarchical organization. So perhaps one of the answers to your question could be that the governments of the day, and probably the governments of today, wouldn't work very well with MPA. I mean, as I understand it, the West Coast Mental Health Network in Vancouver has just had their funding cut by the Greater Vancouver Health Authority because they don't fit within their mental health system. That's what I think the rationale is. Well, the West Coast Mental Health Network is a patient-run, a bottoms-up organization like MPA. So it would suggest to me that the state is still unwilling to see patients as their own experts.
That's true.
So I think that it was a radical model, and radical models have a hard time making it into the mainstream. MPA never provided employment for psychiatrists or people with power in the system. It rubbed up against the established power bases, and I think in very effective ways. But that didn't, in the long term, it didn't create lasting support for the organization. You know, it seems to me so obvious that the MPA was a model that worked and should have been copied and taken up across Canada. And parts of it were, in that there is an acknowledgement of the patient perspective and the patient voice and the concept of empowerment. But the powers that be they the state or the professionals, aren't willing to give up the whole show. You know, like we did with making the film, we said, as much as possible, we said, this is your film. You tell us how you want it to take shape and who you want it to be marketed to. But that's very radical in mental health, right?
I think we can jump now to talk a little bit more about the film. Tell me a little bit more about how it came to be.
As I said, we started off with the original interviews in June and July of 2010. And we had our first project meeting in February 2011. We met whenever I was in town, usually in the downtown east side in different places, and not everybody came to the meetings, but the core group was really faithful because it took us a long time to finish the movie, and we had many catastrophes along the way, but the group, including Jackie, were very patient with us and very loyal to the project.
Well, we were interested in it.
I think you guys were interested in the project.
We were.
So there's two things that are important about the film. Of course, the film itself, the product is important, but the process was important. And in a sense, the way that the film came together kind of mimicked the early MPA. But we started by transcribing the interviews and then giving each participant, like Jackie, a chance to review their interviews and decide which they thought were the most significant sections of their interviews. And then I took all those important sections and I grouped them. So, you know, a lot of people, for instance, thought housing was important. And a lot of people talked about the drop-in as this vibrant, empowering place. So that was another topic. And a lot of people talked about the changes and the way in which MPA changed from being this democratic organization to this hierarchical organization. After I kind of clustered these topics, we mapped them onto a storyline collaboratively. And then the group took a look at some kind of key principles about how people with mental health issues should be portrayed in the film, the ethos of the film, kind of a value statement. And so we gave the interview selections this map that we'd created and this value statement to our first editor, and he created a rough draft. And then we had a young film graduate from York, Catalin Pajuchki, who was just critical to the success of the project.
Yeah, she was great.
And he then made the rough draft, and we brought that back to the group, and the group commented, and we went back and forth and put in historical footage and photographs from the NFB and the CBC and people's personal photo collections. And the group also made decisions about who the film should be marketed to. And they were really clear about that as well, because they're a really political group of people. So they were very clear that they wanted people with mental health difficulties to see the film, particularly youth, and they wanted it to be marketed to people working in the mental health system so they would see the model of MPA.
One of the things I was really struck by in the paper that you sent to me, Megan, was, I'm paraphrasing, I'll probably get it a bit wrong, was in one of the sections written by Lanny, he said something like, it was really essential that the filmmakers work with us because otherwise they wouldn't have had the theory to do it right.
Yes.
Explain a little bit what you think he means by that.
The film is kind of a radical historical exercise because historians don't usually do what we've done in the film. And it's part about giving expression to voices from the margin, a kind of a democratization of voice and making history work in the interest of social justice and kind of sharing ownership of history. But Lanny was making that point that people who hold history hold not just information. It's not just that Jackie can tell me about what the early MPA drop-in looked like, but Jackie also has an analysis that's really important. So she holds theoretical understandings that I, as a historian, need to be sensitive to. And writing that paper with Lanny was about as big a project as writing a dissertation, because he challenged everything. He's a really good writer, and so he insisted that my writing be accessible. But he said to me, I want you to think of an illustration from your own life of your experience.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode of Talking Radical Radio, titled Remembering a Radical Experiment. To listen to the remainder of this episode, you can check it out at talkingradical.ca. Earlier in the show, you also listened to an interview with Jérôme Saunier on Montreal accessibility during the summer. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact the Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's spoken word department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Stay tuned for Hearsay. That's up now.
Anti-Fascism, Reflections on the Past and Possibilities in the Present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, Free Improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022, at 9 p.m., La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni per il Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God.